Let's remember that, of course, he played under Roberto Martinez at Wigan, and at the time, he was very much...
And welcome to the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graham Sibley, and as ever, I'm joined by Jan Bilton.
Hello.
No Terry this week. He's on holiday. So it's just me and Jan. Me and Jan to talk about all the excitement of the last day of the summer transfer window. It's very exciting, isn't it, Jan?
It's incredibly exciting. It's all I'm thinking about.
Well, yeah, I hope you're thinking about something else other than just the transfer window. I know it's an easy trap to fall into, isn't it? Because it's just so comfortable and such an easy place to live, isn't it? After the World Cup, there was that little month of narrative where the only thing you can talk about is transfers. It's not really our bag on this podcast, is it, Jan?
Well, not really, because we go out weekly, it's instantly out of date once we've talked about it. So, I mean, tomorrow, and probably as we are speaking now, there's probably conversations happening across the country, across Europe, across the world even, of players moving from A to B. And, you know, we can say something now and it's just gone the next day. So it would be foolish for us to make predictions, which is why we stopped making predictions on the Sound of Football.
Well, yes. There must be a word for that kind of thing. I'm sure Terry would have a word for it, wouldn't he?
Terry's got a word for a lot of things.
Word that he's been using this season on this podcast as well, isn't he? Was it chip baggery, isn't it?
Chip papery.
Chip papery,
I think
chip
it was.
Chip papery, that's it. Yes, a bit yeah, chip
which
papery.
Which is excellent, actually. He's such an articulate man.
Yes, well, there you go. And that's his word. And we're going to use it because he's on holiday. And he won't be using it on holiday. Let's hope he's not using it on holiday. So, yes, although we don't usually talk about transfers, we will talk about it today because it is the closing day. Across the land, all the offices are busily dusting off their fax machines. The intern is on YouTube going, how do you work a fax machine? And all of these things are happening because it's the one day a year when we use archaic technology. We don't, of course, we don't anymore. No one uses a fax machine, but... It's 11 years now since the David De Gea transfer fell through because the fax machine didn't work. And I think that was the last nail in the coffin for the 80s tech being used in football transfers. So we will perhaps refer to the fax machine. Like you say, oh, I taped that program off the telly last night.
No, you didn't. You streamed it.
No, I taped it. I actually got my VHS out the loft.
Did you set the impossible timer?
I set the impossible timer. I had to send away for some analog to digital encoder so that it actually works with my new telly and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But first, what we always do at the start of every episode is just ease our way in with a little chat about what happened at the weekend and some of the more sparky talking points that we saw. Good result for your guys, Jan. Sunderland winning at home to Fulham. 1-0 wasn't too exciting for all I heard. I didn't see any of it myself.
Well, you missed precisely nothing. It was terrible. Fulham didn't manage a shot on target in the entire game. And that's not to say it was all Sunderland, because it wasn't. First half was forgettable. So was a lot of the second half. But Reggie changed things up, brought Diarra on and Wilson Isidore. And within a few minutes, we'd hit the post, which should have been in from Isidore. And a few minutes later, he put the lads into the lead, following a pass from Lefebvre. And the relief was felt. I was listening to a Sunderland pod earlier today and they were saying how kind of reserved it felt in the stadium, almost like a low. First game at home and, you know, there's a lot, the club did a lot to make it a real occasion leading up to it. But yeah, it was a pretty rubbish game, but the relief was felt there when Isidore scored that goal. It was felt all the way as far south as my house because I leapt from the sofa and instantly put my back out because of my age. I think there was a little bit of pressure there, having lost on the opening game to Ipswich, which was our own making. But yeah, a good 3 points against a team that we need to be above. So yeah, pretty pleased with that.
My team, Arsenal, haven't played yet this weekend, and our recent record against Aston Villa is not great. The games I watched this weekend, I did watch quite a lot of the United-Ipswich game, and that had an interesting talking point in it, didn't it, Jan? Ipswich had the lead, didn't they, for a fair chunk of that match. They had the lead at half-time, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And Leith Davis, did you see his goal?
Yes.
Absolute belter. And the thing about Ipswich, and I will say this now, I think Ipswich are going to be all right this season. Because having witnessed them tear through Sunderland last week, I mean, like I said, it was of our own making, but they certainly capitalised on it. And on both occasions, it was 2-1. And seeing them yesterday against Man United, they've got some incredibly pacey players. And because of that, they can break incredibly quickly and cause a lot of problems. And I think lesser teams than Man United, I think they'll get some points on the board this season. So yeah, well done to them. Although 5-2 makes it sound like a hammering, but I don't really think it was. But certainly for, I think the second goal you're probably referring to, are you?
Yes.
The own goal by Jacob Greaves. But of course, leading up to that was where the controversy was, because I forget the name of the player that was trying to chip the ball over Harry Maguire, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And Maguire's hands, as he was running towards it, came up to almost go across his chest. But looking at it again, there was a really interesting piece from Shea Given on the BBC when he argued that he was bringing his hands up. You could almost say maybe to defend his face or maybe to kind of charge the ball down, kind of rugby style, and then didn't know what to do with his hands. But the upshot of it was, Graham, that he controlled the ball with his arms and was able to dribble the ball into the box and then let loose a speculative shot, which was going to, I mean, it would be lucky if it was going to trouble the corner flag. But it hit off Greaves and went in. You know, a lot of very kind of nasally people were saying, well, to the lesser of the law. But to me, I think Shea Given changed my mind on this. I think it looks to me like a deliberate handball. I don't think it could be anything else. His hands were in an unnatural position, so the referee should have just blown for it straight away because that's the handball. And the fact that it went on to get a goal only holds water if you believe that he wasn't trying to control that ball, which I think he was. It would have made no difference, I don't think, to the eventual outcome, but it adds to Ipswich's goal difference and Man United, so it does have an effect going forward. But yeah, really strange one, really. And handball should be really easy, shouldn't it? It should be straightforward, and it isn't.
When I first saw it, I thought it was not a deliberate handball. The ball was almost kicked against him, it was so close. It's a coming together on the edge of the box, isn't it? And the ball luckily lands at Maguire's feet, and you're right, he takes a speculative shot, and it's very much a Harry Maguire shot from the edge of the box, isn't it? And you're right, it was probably throw-in bound more than anything, and deflects at right angles off Greaves and into the goal. 15 years ago, that would have been a goal anyway. Unless the referee blew up for a handball, which he wouldn't have done, there would have been no argument about it. But they did change the law. They changed the law. I can't remember the exact date. The example we always bring up is Alexis Sanchez scoring for Arsenal against Hull, I think it was, when he had his arm across his chest. The ball bounces off his arm and into the goal. And because it was an accidental handball or not deliberate handball, it was a goal because that's how the law was then. And then someone said, well, that shouldn't be a goal. That doesn't feel right that that should be a goal. So what we'll do is we'll write it down in law and say, look, if it comes off your arm and goes into the goal, it can't be a goal. And everyone thought that would be a great idea. That sounds great. You shouldn't be able to score with your hand, accidental or not. But the trouble is, in this occasion, what happened was the ball has come off his arm, fallen at his feet, he's taken a shot, and then it's hit an opponent and then gone in. So it's an own goal. But, I mean, all right, to the letter of the law, that is the goal. But had the shot been on target, it would have been ruled out. It just seems to me that the logic is wrong. And the referee should be able to say, no, I don't care what the letter of the law says, the spirit of the game says, or the smell of the game, or the vibe of the game, whatever, says that, no, you're not going to get that goal. I don't care. I think it did have some material effect on the game because a couple of minutes later, Greaves was penalised for a penalty, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was literally 4 minutes later. You're right, that probably did unsettle him. Knowing how important that could be to their survival, ultimately, because that's what they're thinking about.
Yeah. So usually I blame any change on handball squarely at the door of VAR. And I think there is a kind of VAR smell about this decision because everything needs to be put down in black and white now. There's no grey areas in the handball law, because we love to have consistency, don't we? But of course, when we have consistency, what don't we have, Jan?
Common sense.
Yes, exactly. We don't have common sense anymore. And that's what this goal is really about, isn't it, Jan?
Yeah, I think so. Unless you're a Manchester United fan, any other football fans looking at that going, that goal shouldn't have stood, because it shouldn't. And you're right, and I'm pleased it's made its first appearance of the season. It's not within the smell of the game, is it? If anything, it's stinking the game out. And it's a shame, actually, because it was a great game to watch. It really was. Both sides, I thought, played really well. Man United clearly played a lot better and got themselves, well, five goals, four really. And Bruno Fernandes got his hat-trick, and he looked really good, didn't he? Really good. The fact that we're talking about that and we're not talking about how good Man United played and what a good shift Ipswich put in is, you know, it's a shame. It overshadows what was a brilliant, brilliant contest.
It does. And yes, well done to Man United, because after last weekend, they really did turn it around this weekend. So, of course, we could say, yes, well done to all these clubs, or, oh, yes, it's not started too well for them, has it? Still only two games in. I think by the time we get to about three, four, then we can start saying, yeah, yeah, they're rubbish. They're rubbish. They're going down. Yeah, they're rubbish. They're not doing anything. But at the moment, we're still in that kind of period of the season where there's an amnesty on really, really bad takes, isn't there? Unless you're Tottenham.
I was just looking at the table there, staring at Tottenham, holding the rest of the division up, and thought, yeah, they're not getting away with this, are they? Surely.
Well, no. There's easing your way into a season. City have shown that, haven't they? They played poorly against Arsenal in the Community Shield when it really didn't matter. They wobbled a bit against Bournemouth in their first game at home, and then they went to Palace on Friday night and they absolutely stuffed them, didn't they? So that's an example of easing your way, not taking too much into the first game that they played of the season. However, Tottenham, whoa, all that money they've spent over the summer, and they got absolutely schooled, didn't they, by Newcastle, didn't they?
Newcastle, who, it pains me to say this, are putting my Sunderland hat on the shelf. They're going to tear it up this season based on a sample of two. But I'm really impressed with how they've started. Again, you talk about a team in transition. Eddie Howe left. He'd been there for a long time. There was a feeling, I think, amongst the support that it'd gone a bit stale there. He wanted to leave himself. They brought in Yeisler, who was known, but not potentially at this level, you could argue. And Wisser and Elanga, who were there last season and really didn't... I mean, Wisser was kind of anonymous last season, really. Elanga, clearly not his usual self. The last two games, they've been... I mean, Wisser's goal yesterday when he flipped that one over his shoulder, whoa. I mean, where did he come from? And Elanga again with the other one. I don't think we're going to be getting the double over those this season again. But the point is that Tottenham went to Brentford, a brilliant side. And yeah, they're going to have a difficult afternoon against them. And they did. They lost 3-0 and then go to Newcastle, who are resurgent. And it makes you think, where are their points coming from? Because they've got Forest next, who are doing all right. Then they've got Everton. And then they're playing Liverpool in the League Cup. I mean, it's going to be tough. It really is. When you spent £300 million.
Yeah.
You know, all the excuses about, you know, who was above in the hierarchy in the club are not there anymore. You've got the coach you wanted. You've got the free spending that you wanted. And you're still bottom of the league. Which is wonderful. Because it's just, it's great to see Tottenham struggle. And I'm not even an Arsenal fan.
Well, I mean, I was looking at it when you were thinking about, okay, well, they've spent a lot of money. But then I suppose they've had to spend a lot of money because you've got to be able to bring players in and say, well, you're not going to be playing in Europe this season, but we are investing. We're buying all these other players as well so that we are pushing on and we have got a vision. We've got a direction of travel. But, oh, I mean, Tonali is taking time to settle in, obviously. But I looked at the way that Newcastle played, and you're right, Wissa's goal was just, that was a player with confidence. That was a player who just, the ball is coming to me, right, okay, I'm going to try this. Players who don't have confidence, like you see in Tottenham, that won't come off. That just doesn't work for those players. But this is what the new setup at Newcastle have got right. They're somehow, I mean, Elanga scored one goal last season. He's already got two this season. And that's another sign of confidence because he's going for those balls. He's going into the channels, chasing it down. what we always known that player to be. And it's paying off for him because somehow the new manager there has given him the confidence to go and try things out. They look like they're in really, really good shape at the moment. Again, it could just be one battering away from taking all that early confidence away, but I don't think it is. I think you've got a good side there at the moment. And yeah, just on the sample of two, they are going in a good direction and a direction that would almost certainly get them European football at the end of the campaign.
Yeah, I agree. I think they're in a good place. And, you know, going back to the Spurs thing, they can argue that they're a team in transition, but, you know, not to leave the team that we mentioned just in this conversation, Newcastle are a team in transition, huge transition. And there's a lot of politics going on about the ownership there as well, which we've talked about previously. And they've hit the ground running. They really have. So looking at the early start, I mean, there's a lot of pressure on Tottenham, on Villa potentially tonight after the champions have a go at them. When you've got Hull, got 6 from 6.
Yeah.
You know, they just don't care. They're just going out there and going, we're just going to have a lovely, lovely time. But they're doing the absolute right thing. They're just going out there and going for it. And I have 6 points on the board already. That's going to make a hell of a difference towards the end of the season. So, you know, they're going to get turned over at some point without a shadow of a doubt. They're brand new to the league and it's going to happen. But yeah, it's good to see them setting the running already. That's great to see.
First thing I thought when Hull came up was they've come up as playoff champions, and that team historically never really does well. But also we've seen sides that come up as supposedly sort of organised defensively. Remember Burnley when they come up last season. They'd had that immense season in the Championship where they barely conceded any goals. And I think you said at the start of the season, they'll have conceded that number of goals by the end of September. And I don't think you were that far off. It was a throwaway comment. But it's such a different beast. But they do seem to have their defence sorted out. Yeah, they sit deep, but they're a new Premier League club. So why not?
Yeah.
So let's see what they're like with a team that does really well on crosses. If they're going to give that many away, we'll see how they get on. But I think at the moment, you've got to look at them and say, well, they're taking points where the points are available. And the points were available against Man United and they took them. The points were available against Coventry and they took them. So they only need a handful more of those and they'll be safe, really.
Exactly. And they've got Villa next. And as things stand, Hull at home to a Villa side off the back of two losses. But can I just say something about a team that we love to hate because they're an awful football club? But how entertaining are Chelsea at the moment? They are like, it made me think of like late 90s, like Keegan's Newcastle. It was just absolutely mental, that game yesterday. What was all that about? I mean, that was happening at the same time as the Sunderland game, which was not exciting in any way, shape or form. But yeah, Chelsea against a brilliant Brighton side. I mean, for a 4-3 on a Sunday afternoon. I mean, I really wish I'd watched that one now. But crazy. Look, brilliant going forward. Leaky at the back. No one cares as long as we score more than you. So it's good. Hopefully that continues because I just love mad results like that. So yeah, keep it going, Chelsea, and people might actually start liking you.
I made the mistake. Well, I made a couple of mistakes during that game because I was watching that until it got to 3-0 and I thought, do I really want to see Chelsea absolutely batter Brighton? And I thought, no, I don't. I'll switch over and watch Leeds Brentford instead. And Brighton scored almost immediately. And then it got to 3-2. So as soon as it got to 3-2, I turned back and then Chelsea score again. I thought, all right, okay, fates. I know what this is. Yeah, maybe this is their tribute to King Kev. Chelsea have had teams like that that have played expansive football. I think like the team of Zola and Vialli. When they were still an acceptable side because they didn't have all the money and they weren't in the Champions League. They made it to the cup final in 94 and then they won it in 97, didn't they? And that was the limit of their annoyingness. And then, of course, you know, all the money came in, didn't it, and changed everything.
Yeah, it did.
So, yeah, keep your eye on Chelsea, I suppose. Now, Liverpool, though. Let's talk about Liverpool because Liverpool scored 4 goals this season in 2 games. All of them have been equalisers. Yeah, that's a stat, isn't it?
I've spotted that stat. It is a stat. So they drew 2-2 with Newcastle, didn't they, on opening day?
Yeah.
At Newcastle.
Yeah.
And had to pull that one back.
Twice.
And then it was 2-2 against Forest at Anfield.
At Anfield, yeah. And again, They had to get back into that game twice. Alexander Isak scored, so I suppose that's one thing that was a positive from the game. But I think you said the other week, didn't you, about how Areola took his time to settle into Bournemouth, didn't he? So
yeah,
the alarm bell shouldn't be ringing there, even though they've just splashed out another £123 million on another forward player, Bradley Barcola.
I think they'll be all right. Iriola's a great manager. The player I really like, he scored the equaliser yesterday, was Victor Munoz. He's going to be amazing. When he came on against Newcastle, you could just see just the way that that guy likes to get forward. And his goal yesterday was pretty special as well. So we talked about teams in transition because of changes. There's been a lot of changes at Liverpool. But they're still getting the points and they're still scoring the goals. And once they get that right, I think they're going to be fine. You know, it might just take another couple of £100 million in the next few hours, and they'll crazy amounts of money that they're spending, but they're clearly gunning for it. There's an opportunity to do that now because, you know, City, as you said, are finding their way post Guardiola, and you can't let Arsenal run away with it. So, you've got to invest heavily, and that's what they're doing.
The thing is, unless there is more business to be done, is how much cover they've got at the back. Jacko, the new signing they've got, he looked good. He looked really, really good. They are only a couple of injuries away from it looking pretty threadbare in that defence. So Areola is very good at bringing defenders in and organising defence. That's one thing he really did well at Bournemouth, especially when every summer all of his defenders would get sold. So I think he fancies himself to actually do that with what they've got. Certainly could probably get a tune out of Kirkes where Slot couldn't. So maybe he backs himself to do it there, but it does look like they're short defensively. And especially whenever you look at the numbers, they are shocking numbers, really. I mean, how many times have they spent over £100 million on an attacking player just in the last 18 months or so?
Van Dijk is a fantastic player, but he's like any player, he's got a shelf life. And I just don't think he's the megastar central defender he used to be. And maybe he's getting towards the end of his career. With Liverpool, that is. Maybe they need to upgrade there. Staying with players that were brilliant a few years ago is all very well, but you know they need to be performing now. And you're right, they are short at the back. Maybe they need to bring in another player or two, maybe just to support that position.
I think there is probably still a chance that more business will be done. Maybe they will actually get rid of Cody Gakpo. I don't know why, because he had a cracking game yesterday against Forest. Let's talk about something else, though, because this season's going to be a special one on The Sound of Football, because this season is the first time that all three of us have got our teams in Europe. Now, I'm an Arsenal fan, so we're pretty much always in Europe. I think we've only missed out on one season of all the 18 seasons that we've been doing this pod. But, of course, it's a new experience for my co-host, for Jan, Sunderland fan, and for Terry, who's a Palace fan, although he does also support Dortmund, so he gets his European kicks through there. But now all three of our English clubs are in Europe together at the same time. It's fabulous, isn't it, Jan? I mean, we had the draw last week, the mega table draw. Palace and Sunderland, same competition, a couple of the same opponents as well, haven't you?
Yeah, we have. I think both the Polish teams, Poznan and, I'm going to struggle to say this, Jagiellonia, probably completely wrong, but there you go. We're playing, so we've both got trips to Poland, which is going to be great. From a personal point of view, I'm speaking for the people, the good people of Sunderland here. There's a chance that our cousins up the road tend to roll out on the few times they've played in the Champions League competition, when they've sung, "You'll never see a Macam in Milan." Well, sadly, lads, that came back to bite you, because in December, Sunderland will be playing in the San Siro. I mean, that made it all sweet. I mean, it just had to be. But that aside, Sunderland, as recently as 2021, were in the third tier English football. In December, we'll be playing against one of the biggest teams in Milan, which is, I mean, that's just huge. After they won the FA Cup back in 73, they got knocked out in the second round of the Cup Winners' Cup by Sporting, which is a big fixture.
Yeah.
But playing Milan, I mean, I think it just dwarfs that, no offence to my Portuguese friends. Yeah, looking forward to that one immensely. I am probably going to go out there in the full knowledge that I've got no chance of getting a ticket, but just to go out there. Yeah. There's a few of my friends from back at home, and my son seems quite keen to do it. I mean, it's quite expensive.
Yeah.
Trip just to go out and watch Sunderland play in a bar. But it's a bit like when a lot of teams do, it's not just Sunderland, but, you know, they go to, whenever we go to London, we tend to take over Trafalgar Square, for example.
Yeah.
Other teams do it, I know. But to go out to Milan and find a lovely little town square or something like that, with all the tables there and still there when we leave as well, because we're not like that. We just have a few beers in a European market square and then just soak up the atmosphere. It'd be wonderful. And we're going off to Portugal as well to play the Portuguese cup holders, who are in the second division. Torriense, we're playing against them. They have to play in the local municipal stadium because theirs is so small. But that's worth a trip as well. It's not too far from Lisbon. Yeah, very much looking forward. It feels real now. It's going to be wonderful. Of course, Bournemouth as well, they're playing Milan, and they've got a trip to Real Sociedad.
Yeah, Palace are away to Lyon, and that's certainly a lovely trip if Terry could make that one, because I went to Lyon end of last season for Arsenal women's semi-final, which they lost, but a fabulous stadium, fabulous city. Yeah, Bournemouth away trip to San Sebastian, another lovely city. Actually, I've been to all three of those cities, of those pot one teams, actually, because I've been to Milan as well, and Milan is lovely. And the San Siro, get out there while it's still there, and it's only going to be there for another 3 or 4 years, isn't it? That round, the one that's 2 weeks before Christmas as well, that's where you always want to find a city that's got a nice Christmas market vibe going on there. I think Milan might have a wonderful Christmassy vibe to go to. I think you'll have an amazing time if you went out there, even if you didn't get to see the game. I think that would be brilliant. Palace have got a real stinker of a draw there, I think. The way that it's done now, you get an equal number of teams from the different strata. Of course, Palace and Sunderland, because they don't have any history in the tournament, although Palace did literally win a European trophy last season, ended up being pot three teams. But it doesn't make that much of a difference because, let's face it, Celtic were in pot two. And we all know how terrible they were last week. Yeah.
Stinkers.
Stinkers. But Palace's pot four teams are Hoffenheim at home and their Sitkas away. Now, compared to Sunderland, who have got a second division Portuguese side for their away game, and Bournemouth have got Lillestrøm away, that's going to be a tough one. This is the club where they've got Germany's, I think, third choice goalkeeper now, Nübel, and they've got Leo Trossard is playing for Besiktas as well. So they've got some players at Besiktas, and that's not going to be easy at all. That's not going to be an easy 3-point away trip, that one.
Going away to Turkish sides is notoriously challenging.
Yeah.
Just because of the atmosphere they create. Yeah, that's not going to be let's turn up and just show them how the Premier League's done. That's going to be tough, as you said, because some good players and a hostile crowd. And Hoffenheim's a difficult game as well for them as well. I know they've got that at home. I mean, if you want to win it, you want to play you have to play the best teams. Palace have already got themselves a European trophy, so they should know what it's all about, really.
Well, of course, Arsenal, they had quite a tough draw as well in the Champions League. Arsenal got Real Madrid and Bayern Munich as their pot one teams. Away to Bayern Munich. And, oh, my God, again. I thought this draw meant we'd face different teams. I mean, Real Madrid, we played them last season, all right, in the knockout stage, and we scored a couple of cracking goals. But we got Dortmund. Dortmund, they seem a bit familiar as well. Dortmund at home, Betis away, Lille at home, Napoli away, Sabah at home, and Slavia Prague away. Yeah, so Liverpool will also be playing in Milan as well because they're playing Inter as their pot one team.
Arsenal's games there, with the exception of Sabah and playing in Prague, they're challenging games, aren't they?
You're not
looking at those going, yeah, that'll be all right.
Yeah, yeah. Compare it to Liverpool's, and I think Liverpool have got perhaps the easiest of the draw. Villa have got PSG and Barcelona. United at home to Bayern and away to Atletico Madrid. Atletico Madrid going to the Metropolitano is difficult. We've all seen how teams have struggled there in recent years.
Mm.
City have got PSG at home and away to Barcelona. Interesting ties as well. Any other standout fixtures you can see on those?
Well, I mean, just at the top of my list, the first one to jump out, which is such as the strength of the competition, but Barcelona playing against PSG. In Paris.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to face up to a lot of football writers, a lot of people who have opinions about football. moaning about the mega table. And you will probably hear lots of moaning on other podcasts about the mega table. And I'm getting more used to it now, and I'm prepared for it as it comes in. I like the mega table. I do. I just like the system. I like the what we call the Swiss model. I think it's a good thing. But I do know where these guys are coming from when they say, I don't like it. It's too many meaningless games. And it's no improvement on the old group stage. It is, I think, because you're playing lots more different teams. There's a lot more variety in it. But I think, for me, the problem that other people have with it is, especially if you're a football writer, you're struggling to find the narrative of games. Because this isn't like a domestic game where there's always going to be beef, something you can hook into, whether it's just like historic beef, local rivalries, which you just don't get in European competition. You may have a couple of players who've switched clubs or something like that, or a result from a couple of seasons back in the Champions League that there was beef afterwards, usually involving Chelsea. That's all I'm saying on that one. because they really are an awful football club.
They are.
They are. But you don't get that in European competition because these are from different countries. They don't face each other twice a year. They face each other once a year. All right, Arsenal and Bayern face each other a lot. But even then, you don't build up that kind of rivalry. The fans will attach something to it. They'll think, oh God, it's Bayern again. We're going to get stuffed because they're thinking about results from about 10, 12 years ago. It's a lot different now. But I think for most football writers, they've got to be able to hook onto something. And they struggle in this because it is just a big league. And you only have to get in the top two-thirds of it to do anything. And I think it's also difficult to gauge how well teams are actually doing in it. A friend of the show, Andrew Beasley, has a great table that he brings out on Blue Sky after every round of fixtures. I hope he's doing it this season as well. He's writing for The Guardian now, so maybe his time spent for them will mean that he won't have time to do that very helpful table. But what it does is it shows you how well each club are actually doing compared to which teams they've played. It has the table. Instead of just doing number of wins, number of points, number of goals, etc., what it does is it has like a colour-coded bar which shows you which teams from which pot they've played. So if they've already played their pot one sides, those will be either red or green, depending on if they've got a win or a loss, or yellow, I think, for a draw. But last season, it was apparent because Inter took a really early lead on the table, but I think they'd played all of their four easiest games. So looking at that table, you could see, okay, well, they're top, but they've got a load of tough fixtures to come. And it just made sense. And I think if something like that, if you switch over to a new way of looking at the data, or a new way of visualizing the data anyway, then I think you will get more into what the new league system is. I think that it still requires us to get used to it. But I can see why people think, oh, it's too many games. So many pointless games, but that's football. There are so many pointless games in football. So many pointless games in football.
And it's not like there weren't pointless games in the previous iteration of the competition. Yeah. And as well as that, playing the same team home and away, I mean, that was just, that just made it really boring. The group stages for me was infinitely boring. There was the odd good encounter in it.
Yeah.
But the Champions League didn't really get interesting until after Christmas. So when Sunderland went in the Premier League, I just didn't bother with the subscription until after Christmas because it just wasn't worth it. It was just like, what's the Champions? Because it just wasn't interesting. Whereas this, I think it creates a lot more interest. It's given the bigger clubs the chance to play each other, which keeps the European Super League in check. And I really like the massive table, one, because it's a massive table. What's not like? It's more of something. It's going to be better. But seriously, though, I also like the way that they play everything on the last game. Everyone kicks off at the same time. So you've got some jeopardy there. I really like that. I think they've nailed it with that. So I think we just need to give it you need to give it a run, don't you? But I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, I've become converted. Now I'm looking forward to the whole of the competition, rather than just the knockout stages. So if the job was to, as I've said, keep the bigger clubs happy, put a few more games in there so everyone gets a bit more money, but to bring in and engage more fans, well, certainly on that last point, on a sample of me, it's worked.
Yeah.
So well done.
Yeah.
Well done, UEFA. We love UEFA now, don't we? All is forgiven.
Just about. Just about. They are just less evil. Let's not...
This is true. This is true.
And it's only a little bit less evil, anyway. Well, that's the stuff we'll be watching into the winter, isn't it? But there's plenty of football that we'll be watching this weekend, isn't there? And we start on Friday night with the return of the WSL, with the London City Lionesses against Manchester United. London City Lionesses, who have been busy in the transfer market. So that'll be a great tie to start off with, because really Manchester United is the team that they're gunning for in the WSL. What their long-term plan is, because they're not going to be able to get into the Champions League because their owner is also the owner of Lyon, who are the current champions of the Champions League. Arsenal play Chelsea on Sunday. That'll be entertaining, won't it, Jan?
It took the words right out of my mouth. Based on what we've just spent an hour talking about, that promises, anyway, to be an absolute belter. Yeah, expect a 4-3 or something like that. I mean, that, on paper, that's what it looks like it's going to get to, doesn't it? It's probably going to end up being a 0-0 stinker. I'm already looking forward to that one. It's going to be great.
And if you want to see what we pick for the seven games we think you should be watching from Friday to Sunday, then get along to sofpodcast.com, click on the link for the weekend box set, and subscribe to our Substack. And it will be in your inbox on Friday lunchtime. But that is all we have time for this week. So from me, Graham Sibley, and from Jan Bilton, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Get in touch with us on Blue Sky or Instagram, where we are at Sound of Football. Or go to sofpodcast.com. Like us, share us, rate us and review us. Do it now!
He's a naughty boy. He's a very, very naughty boy.